What's up, D Squad? Happy Friday or happy whatever day it is when you're listening to this. I'm your host, Duchesela Dohaye, and this is the Discovered Oasis podcast. If you're new here, welcome. I want to tell you a little bit about what we do in this space. Every other Friday, I get to sit down with African returnees who are people of African descent who at some point in their lives lived in a Western world, but have decided to pack their things and move to the motherland. I consider myself a temporary returnee. And sometimes I'll get questions about starting a business in Burundi or visiting Ghana, where I've never been, or even moving to South Africa. And because I don't have answers to those questions, I was like, how about I create a space where people who have answers to those questions can come together and share their stories? And today, I got to talk to Andrea Harahagadzwe, who is a Burundian returnee, and she recently, I want to say recently, although it was last year, released a book, a novel. She gets to tell me today about her story. But before we dive into all of that, let me tell you the story of how I met her. July of last year, my sister was in Burundi and she got the book. She came back and she was like, you have to read this book. I'm like, why? I don't read novels. You should know that. She's like, yeah, but this book is a little special. You have to read it. I'm like, what is so special about this that I have to read it? And she was like, it's about connections. It's about friendships. It's about grief and loss. And it's interesting. You should read it. And I was like, okay, if you say so. Fast forward a couple months later, guess who shows up in my DM? Andrea. And I was like, okay, this is a sign. We have to do this. And talk to her for about an hour on a call. And I was like, yeah, let's make this happen. So you're about to hear our conversation. And I have to give you a disclaimer. It's a two-parter, which means that there's a part one that you're about to listen to, and there's a part two. But don't worry, you're not going to have to wait 2 weeks to hear the second part, because I'm posting it next Friday. You just have to wait for a week. But I promise you, it's really worth it. It happened so organically. I never planned for this to be a two-parter, but the way just the conversation was flowing, I was like, you know what? There's going to be a part one and a part two. But I'm so excited you're here for part one. So I hope you enjoy it. Without further ado, let's dive in. Welcome, welcome.
Thank you, Duchess. So happy to be here.
We're going to start with like the beginning. Your name is Andrea Harahagadzwe. What does your last name mean?
So apparently my last name means, if I were to translate it, I would say that it means that someone important is standing there. But then that's what I thought. Then I talked to my dad, because that was my understanding and my sister's understanding. And then surprisingly, my dad was like, no, it actually means what he thinks it means is that the situation is tense. Like something is about to happen or some dangerous people are there. I don't know. It didn't make sense to me. So I'd rather keep the other one. Someone important is standing there. And that someone I like to think is God, you know? And then because Burundians, we tend to have these, our last names usually point to God in a way. At least many of them, like, I don't know, Hakizimana, and you name it. So I like to think it's God.
I don't think I would have thought that your last name pointed to God in a way, but I love it. I love that it's subtle, you know? It's not like, because for most of our last names, it's like you said, Ndikumana, Iraduhaye. Like even Iraduhaye, if you don't know that E stands for God, then you wouldn't know. But yeah, it's beautifully subtle. So I was telling you off record that I was able to read your book a bit. And today we are here. We are here to talk about a novel that you wrote, but it doesn't sound right for us to jump into the novel before we talk about who is this Andrea, you know, who is the author. So, but there is one, when I first grabbed it, I turned the first or two first pages and I came to this. It said, to my parents, my father, who introduced me to the power of books, my mother, who went to war for me when I couldn't fight. In, you know, a conversation we had, you said your parents were open-minded parents. That's how you define them. And when I read this, I was like, huh, I want to know more. So please tell me, who was this little Andrea growing up to those two parents that you described in just one or two sentences? Tell me about, you know, what her passions were, what were some of the expectations your parents might have had on you and all that.
Little Andrea was a sensitive kid, creative. And I think that my parents, especially my dad, managed to foster that and to encourage that. I like to tell people that I'm like my dad. We are very similar. Loves nature, loves music, is a writer in his own respect. So definitely, I feel like my dad developed that in me. I mean, encouraged the little Andrea to be her authentic self. I think he recognized that in me. Mom was a little bit less bent on the whole artistic, creative, sensitive side of me, but she was a scholar, bent on excellence. So whatever you choose to do, do it well. She was big on education, doing well, doing your best at, you know, whatever you decide to do. I think I thrived in the sense of I love that my dad fostered that in us, wonder, excitement, adventure, travel, all these things. So I feel like I was spoiled in that way because my childhood was beautiful. It was filled with, you know, excitement and adventure and things like that. I used to love to write. I used to write poems, stories. I was in my own little world. My teachers used to describe me as a dreamer. You know, when they have those parent teachers meetings, my mom would hear, she's a dreamer. She spends her time looking through the window outside, you know. So yeah, I think I was a happy kid. I was a happy kid, but I was also, it sounds like a paradox. I was a happy kid, but I was also very melancholic. I don't know if that can coexist, but I really feel like that was the case. Happy in the sense where I was fulfilled. I had many friends. I had my family. We have a big family, many cousins and stuff. But I was also very introspective since I was a kid, in tune with emotions, in tune with my own emotions, but also people's, quite sensitive to people's emotions. So yeah, would hold a little bit of melancholy in my heart in a way. Perhaps it coexists, right? I think it does.
I believe it does. I think for and again, this is some of the things we're going to talk about in the, like, once we start talking about the book. But I feel like for you to be able to pour out the things that you poured out as an artist, as a writer in this book, you need to have spent a lot of time with yourself, in your mind, with just your thoughts, right? Which, you know, as a kid, it sounds weird because kids are, like, you know, all over the place, running and playing and, you know. So when you see a kid that's, like, too much in her head, it kind of feels off. But it sounds like that's what you're describing in a way. So I think they can coexist, as you said. I want us to talk about the way you, with all of this, right? I maybe also the people who are listening would think then you decided to become a writer when you were a kid. But the truth is not quite that. So you pursued your education and something that I would say is completely different from being a writer, right? Tell me a little bit about that. Tell me about why, if you know, why you decided to pursue education in the field that you did.
So perhaps for context, in my secondary education, I went into the science lane because, I mean, very simply in Burundi, there is a sort of, I don't know if I could call it pressure or some norms that make that certain things are better than others. I think it's the case anywhere in the world. But in Burundi, when it comes to education, there are certain things that have that hold a certain credibility more than others. So in secondary, science was the thing. There was no such thing as, I don't know if in English you would say literature field, or I don't know how you would call it. Like the other, you have science and then you have?
Lettres. That's just, I know, right? It would be like letters. I guess, because it's not really literature though.
It's not. Yes, exactly. It's more, you know, the emphasis is social education, I don't know, social fields, history, etc. So I went into science, not because my parents wanted me to, because both my parents actually chose the other route. But I felt like this is what was expected from us. Everyone who was doing well, who was supposed to do well in school, would pick the science path. And then we had such a general, like a generalized curriculum, such that you would have all these science subjects, but also have the quote-unquote the literature topics like history, you know, French, English, etc. So it felt like, yes, it was the science route, but it also had a little bit of the other side. But I feel like the if I had to listen to myself, I would have definitely chosen lettres, because I was good at, I loved history, I loved French, I loved English, anything that involved storytelling, basically. I loved it. But there's no way I would have chosen that. And so I went into that field, into science, without much conviction. And it didn't help that I was okay, like I did well in all these subjects. And then in university, I chose to do economics start with economics so that I can go into audit without even knowing what audit was. Someone convinced me that it's a good job that is going to get you good money. And at the time, I had completely lost any sense of this is what I want to do. This is what I want to study. I just wanted to find something that was good enough. And so I went into that field, economics in France, did 2 years of economics and then switched to this other institute that, yeah, specializes in audit, internal controls and things like that. And then, yeah, completely forgot about the you know, writing and, I mean, really not even something I would consider that I had in my mind at all, you know? Didn't even write at that time, actually.
Yeah, you found your way back to writing at some point, and we'll talk about that. But knowing that you did economics, and I did economics as well in university, and I remember hating so much and being like, okay, why am I? Because I've never been a math person or a science person altogether. I think for you, luckily, you were still able to do science, but honestly for me, no. Like I don't even think it would have been an option. You know, it would have been one of those things where it's like, okay, you want to do science, then you're just gonna fail. Let's just face it. You know, and sometimes when I look at where I'm at in my career, I'm like, oh my God, had I known, you know? But it's one of those things, one of those paths that we go on, not knowing where it's going to lead us, but somehow we find our way. Let's talk about a book, Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. What does that book mean to you? And what did it inspire you to do in 2018?
Well, I read that book, yeah, as you said, in 2018. And I found it striking, the whole concept of leaving your country to go study abroad is something that spoke to me. But the thing that stuck especially is the main character is a blogger. And I had been thinking about blogging. I had felt the urge to blog for a long time, but I kept putting it off. And then somehow, I remember I was at the beach reading the book. When I was reading the part where you, I think it's Ifemelu, if I'm not mistaken, because I haven't read it since, the part where, you know, they speak about her blog, I just felt like it's time. It's time. I just closed that book when I was done. I went back home and I started creating the blog. Yeah. I was like, this is it. I'm done. I have to do it. It inspired me so much. And I felt like I had put it off for a long time. I needed to get with the program. So I created it in February. And I had just returned from Zanzibar. That's where I was reading the book. Then I decided that my first blog would be an account of my time in Zanzibar.
Nice. Do you think that it's you getting back to writing had been something that was on the back of your mind, but then, you know, giving you all the reasons not to do it? Or before you launched your blog, was it something that maybe you were journaling, you know, or writing, but not publicly?
Exactly. I was journaling. But you see, the thing is, we don't consider journaling as writing, right? We don't. And I think it could be one of the first steps of, because blogging is really journaling and making it public, right? So I had been journaling for several years. I don't even remember when I started journaling. That's how far back it goes. But that, the journaling then transitioned into blogging, which was really putting these ideas a little bit, you know, making them more organized and then releasing them for anyone who would like to read them. So it was really journaling, but making it public. And that's what I tell people. If you journal, chances are you are a writer. If you wanted to write, you could. Because you process things by putting them on the paper. That's all you need to be a writer, really. Because we think it's a big thing, like you have to be this or that, you have to have a style. You discover these things as you write. I don't think there's such a thing as someone who is born a writer. You just become one
as you practice it, basically. I agree. I think, and it's true, because not everybody will always be comfortable, will even be comfortable journaling, right? Some people will be like, I don't have the time for that. I can't even put my thoughts down, right? Which somehow it's like when already you're in this vibe of, you know, journaling or just picking up a paper and start writing about your thoughts or anything that you're seeing, chances are you have that in you.
100%. And I think we should definitely demystify that, you know, making it accessible to anyone. It's not a complicated thing. It's you, like any art, any painting. It doesn't have to be great for you to be a painter or, you know. Super revolutionizing whatever. They just have to be. I think we need to, it should be accessible to anybody, I think.
It should. I agree. What was the main topics on your blog?
Mostly my faith. I speak about my faith. I write about my faith, but also travels, the travels I've had the chance to experience, and fiction, short fictional stories.
Did you ever think that this blog would one day become a novel? Do you remember, if it ever happened, being like, this can actually be more than just a blog?
So there's this post that I wrote and published in 2019. It was my first attempt at writing a fictional story. And it has elements of travel, of, I don't know, I think it's travel mainly. I have to go back and read it because I don't remember exactly. But that's the blog I came back to when I was bored one day, towards the end of 2019, I believe. And I said to myself, I want to write a story. I was bored and I felt like I needed to write something. I wanted to write something that would give me hope in the moment I was in, and that would, it was for me. So that would give me hope. So I started writing it on my laptop, but I didn't know what it was. I just felt like there was a story that I needed to release, if there's such a thing. I started typing, and then after like an hour or a little bit more, after 15 to 20 pages written, I had a story. But then to write that story, I decided to go back to that blog and reverse engineer it. So I had the story of a lady who was traveling, who was discovering this place and etc. I decided to think about like what would be happening in her life prior to her being there. I decided to use that blog. And so I started writing this story, this girl who lives in New York. And yeah, 20 pages, a little bit less later, I had something that I didn't know would become a book.
20 pages that turned into 305. That's how many pages you have in your book.
Yep, basically. That is oversimplifying it, but yeah, that's...
I feel like it's something that started with you seeing the possibility of it and giving yourself the chance to dream bigger, to go bigger, right? It's like, oh, if I can do 15, 20 pages, then that probably means I can do more.
It didn't become a novel. I didn't acknowledge it as a novel until really later. I kept coming back to it after sometimes months. Feeling the nudge to go back to that story and explore it a little bit more. But really, I didn't acknowledge that this would, you know, that actually I'm writing a book until later. And when I started especially telling people that, you know, when they're asking you, what are you up to these days? And you have actually accepted that you're writing a book. So I started saying it. Then, you know, accountability kicks in and it becomes a real thing. And sometimes I would regret, you know, mentioning that I'm writing a book, because sometimes I would write just because I had, you know, told people that I was writing a book just to prove that I can finish it. So yeah, anyways, it wasn't like a linear process where I started writing and then realized, okay, I'm writing a book. No, it was tug of war. In a sense.
Do you remember at what point it was that you were like, okay, this is a novel, or it's a novel to be? Was it like a specific moment, or was it in the midst of all of those little things, like saying it out loud and people asking you?
Definitely the latter. It became real when I started talking about it and I had to finish it.
That's interesting. I want to know what it was like for you to decide that you were done in France. Was it a decision that you made? Was it accidental? Was it intentional? And when you landed in Burundi, was it something that you're like, okay, I'm here and I'm going to stay and I'm going to write a book?
Okay, so my departure from France was because I couldn't find a job. I had applied to so many, I mean, I had tried to get a job in the field I had studied, which is, again, audit, finance. But I couldn't find anything. Not that I was really, really sad about it, because I hated it. Okay, maybe hate is a strong word, but I really disliked the field I was in. But then I managed to get an opportunity in Nairobi, someone who was interested in my background and liked the fact that I could speak English and French and needed that. So that was my first job. I went to Nairobi for my first job, and then I left Nairobi to Bujumbura because I had gotten another job here that was better than what I was doing. And so I came back to Bujumbura in 2014, and I was happy. I mean, I was happy with the idea of coming back home, because I had started to slide into a sort of depression when I was in Nairobi. I thought that coming back home would, give me a little bit more joy and hope, and, you know, that I would find myself again in a way. And I didn't know back then that it was depression, by the way. In hindsight, you know what these things are. But in the moment, I felt like I was a little bit sad, a little bit unmotivated. So I came back to Bujumbura in June 2014, with my hopes up, but also feeling really, really disconnected with myself, disconnected from my family, from my friends, but couldn't explain it. I didn't understand what was happening. My return wasn't glorious, to say the least. Everything on paper seemed nice because the job was great. You're returning home. Everything was supposed to be great, but it wasn't. It was far from it. And actually, I feel like it made things even harder because you know you're supposed to be grateful and happy, but you're not.
I love that you touched on the subject of home, because it's one that really keeps coming back in the conversations that I have with my guests. And we've had the chance to talk, and I know your relationship with Burundi is a little bit shaky.
I like how you put it. Such a nice way to put it.
It's just a tiny bit shaky, you know? You know, and somehow it's something that I want for us to talk about, because whenever we talk, or most of the conversations that I have, when my guests are like, yeah, and then I decided to go home, I feel like sometimes it kind of takes away the fact that it's not always easy, you know. Mm-hmm. But how has it been for you navigating adulthood in Burundi?
That is a loaded question. I want to start off by saying, I mean, I love Burundi. I've always loved Burundi. I feel like when I was a kid, actually, I just remembered that. When I was a kid, I used to pray and thank God that I'm Burundian, which is completely, like, when I think about it, I'm like, what? I used to really thank God that I'm Burundian. I don't know why, but then those were the good days, right? When you're small, you just, you know what I mean? You're just living your life, living your best life, basically. I feel like I would say I love Burundi, but Burundi doesn't love me, which is a strong thing to say.
Yeah.
It sounds a little bit exaggerated in the sense that I feel like I don't fit the norms. If I think there is such a thing as norms, cultural norms in a certain place. And I feel like Burundi, her demands, I don't really meet in terms of, the simple things like being married at a young age or a reasonable age, quote unquote. I'm going to turn 38, by the way, this year. Being 38, not married, with no kids. I mean, people have questions, you know. But then, you know, I came to understand that certain countries, this is something that I heard, if you allow me to unpack it. I'm not sure I'm going to do it justice. But there's this lady, I don't remember her name, and I'm sorry, maybe I'll check later. But she explained that there are two types of paradigms in terms of culture and norms and, you know, societal expectations and things like that. So you have, on one hand, countries that have the paradigm of good versus bad. So you tend to find like the Western countries, the Western world in that category, where it's more like, is it legal or illegal? So is it good or bad? And then on the other hand, you have countries where the bar is higher. It's not just good versus bad. It's honor versus shame. Good versus bad is easy, right? It's the things that we all can agree on. It's actually even very, it's based on one individual, right, at a time. But honor versus shame is determined by the community, the group, and it's gray. It's the gray area, but it's very real. Like, something is not bad, it's not illegal, but it's shameful. So the Western world is on one side, the good versus bad is very simple. You're free to do things. You have a wide range of possibilities in terms of, you know, what you're able to do, how much you're able to express yourself, how much you are able to differentiate yourself on one hand. And then you have countries like maybe, say, the Middle Eastern countries, Middle East countries. And then I would say that Burundi fits into that. Burundi really fits into honor versus shame paradigm. We have a strong sense of what is befitting, what is reasonable, what is, you know, accepted by the community, what is considered good behavior. And when you think about it, sometimes these things are, I want to say, they can be detrimental. Like you can say that something is shameful when it's not, and the effect on the person who's trying either to differentiate themselves or to express themselves, it's very hard to bear. And I feel like Burundi fits into that. So when you do things that attract attention, things that are judged by the community as too revealing or too vulnerable, when you want to express yourself in a way that is not necessarily considered as fitting the norm, then you are a little bit on the shame side of things. You're sometimes even ostracized, canceled, and you name it. I think cancel culture existed in Burundi way before social media brought it. So yeah, so this, I feel like this is the at the root of these things that make it difficult for people who want to do certain things that are outside of the box, like blogging and revealing personal things, like going to a field that is not recognized as serious in a way. You know, you could be a musician. In Burundi, it must be very hard to be a musician. I feel like that explains why Burundi doesn't like
me. Listen, and again, I think I said that a little bit, but the reason why I love that you're touching on this, and I hope, honestly, we can even have more and more conversation about this, is because I believe as African returnees, and I know you're specifically talking about Burundi, but this is something that I've heard across Africans, you know, that were at some point in the diaspora, but then return home, or those, to be honest with you, that have failed despite their desire to help in the evolution of their countries. But they're like, no, we can't, because after you've spent some time abroad or in the Western world where it's good versus bad, and you go back home because it's home, it's, you know, it's where you were raised and everything, and then it's the complete opposite, you kind of have this, there's a conflict in you that goes, hold on a minute, am I crazy? There's this story I remember from a friend of mine, who I think they went, him and his business partner went to this place, I don't know if it was the bank or they were meeting a person who was very important and who was going to fund their business. And he was maybe 30 years old and his business partner was about 45 years old. So there was a huge age gap between the two. And he was telling me how, because my friend who was 30 something was wearing a wedding ring, they took him more seriously than his business partner, who technically was 45 and a bit more experienced, but just because he is married and he has a ring on, then he probably is a wiser man. And which doesn't make any sense.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't. But we absolutely do have that dynamic, which is crazy. It doesn't make any sense.
But I love that you touch on this. I know a lot of the returnees who listen to this will, or even those who are not returnees, are like, this is the reason why I can go back. I know they can relate. So thank you for sharing that, for sure. Okay, I already told you, we're coming back next week for the rest of the conversation. I hope you enjoyed this first part. You can already go ahead and purchase her book. It's on Amazon. And that's what we're talking about next week. We're going to dive deep in how the book came to be, the title, The Sun Sets Everywhere, what's the meaning behind it. If you enjoyed this conversation, make sure you rate it, you send it to somebody who might enjoy it. And as I always say, there's always a path to discovering your own oasis. Until next time.